actually, we have a kind of abundance of riches from these three readings, and you could do three really good things on them. But I just want to briefly mention this business of Abraham and Isaac, the binding of Isaac is a big theme in Jewish thought. What's going on, what the writer is trying to say, is that God is the God of the implausible. You know, the birth of Isaac was itself, you know, Sarah was postmenopausal, Abraham was really old, and yet she had this kid, and then that was implausible. Then they get the kid, and then God said, no, kill the kid. And so, again, God is saying, no, out of all of these impossible situations, I will bring life. So that's what's going on. And this wonderful reading from Romans sort of stands for itself. We could use it as sort of a leitmotif for all of Lent. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? But I want to address the third reading, because every second Sunday of Lent, in all 3 years, has the same narrative. It has a transfiguration story, just like they all begin with the temptation. The second Sunday is always the transfiguration story. So what's going on there? Well, I think the bulk of scholars believe that this probably was some kind of post-resurrection experience that these guys had, which was then thrown back into the historical career of Jesus. And so what is happening here is the anticipation of what God wants for us human beings in the figure of Jesus, namely the end times. This is indicated by these dazzling white clothes. Those are end time clothes. So everybody says you got an end time uniform, you know, and so you put on all these very beautiful, flashingly white clothes. So what does that mean then? What does that do for us? Well, it points a direction, a crucial direction. What is the end time? What is God's intention for us human beings? The kingdom, in a word. The coming of the kingdom. What does that mean? Where we human beings can stand, in the wonderful words of Genesis, naked and unashamed with each other, before each other. That's the kingdom. That's what we human beings are created for. As Paul will say, to be members of each other. This is so alien to us, I think. I mean, we in the West, radical individualism, which says that you're only yourself to the extent that you're separate from and different from everybody else. The great Jean-Paul Sartre has some magnificent passages on that theme. But that's not where it ends. That's not what, according to Jesus and the whole biblical testament, that's not where it ends. Rather, that we are who we are only to the extent that we're truly with each other. Truly with each other. Again, as I said, I think this is a really alien experience for us. I don't think any of us understands ourselves in that fashion. But usually we go through life hunkering down, hoping that nobody beats us on the head, or we can run faster than the people who are going to beat us on the head, so we can escape, you know, from the trammels of being involved with other people. And so it takes an enormous leap of imagination, I think, to envision what we're ultimately called to. But there is an anticipation of this in the life of the church, although here is so often we've sort of botched it badly. The Eucharist is supposed to be the anticipation of the end times. I mean, Panis Angelicus, the bread of angels, you know, all this Eucharistic talk that we get. But here, too, we run into a real problem, and I don't think good old Thomas Aquinas helps us very much in this effort either, because he wants, you know, we have this massive insistence that Jesus is really there in this little kind of magic pill that we're all going to take, you know, at communion time. and Jesus and I are going to enter into some kind of private compact with each other. Well, that's precisely what the Eucharist is not. The Eucharist is supposed to be the anticipation of the end time, because we share bread, we share life in the Eucharist. That's what it's supposed to be about. So when we talk about the real presence, it's not that thing out there. You know. The Eucharist is real only when we are aware of each other. To the extent that we're not aware of each other in the celebration of the Eucharist, it doesn't work. Jesus is not here. Jesus is not present. So this takes, as I said, because we have so emphasized the objectivity of the presence of Jesus. What does it mean to be present? Present is an act of mutuality, folks. Presence is not some kind of virtuosic solo performance by somebody out there. Presence is something that happens between us. Jesus is present to us only to the extent that we are present to each other. As drastic and radical as that sounds, that's the theology of the Eucharist that is authentic. To be aware, therefore, of the distances. To be aware of our absence from each other. For whatever reasons, for whatever antagonisms there exist between us and us and everybody else in the world. To that extent, Jesus is absent. But the awareness of the absence is itself the beginning of Jesus' presence for us. When we know that that's not where we're supposed to be, who we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to be, to the extent that we really do understand that in breaking bread together at this table, and that's what it is, you know, when they turned the altar around at the Second Vatican Council, that was an attempt to restore the early understanding of what the Eucharist is. It's not some guy doing some virtuosic thing facing a wall, which is the way I celebrated Mass when I was first ordained. This is supposed to be bread broken and shared. It's in that gesture of shared life that we can talk about the real presence of Jesus. But again, it's not real presence out there. It has to engage us. And to the extent that it doesn't engage us, there is no Eucharist. We can forget it. But to the extent that we enter into a greater consciousness of each other, then Jesus is present.